Tonight we're going to be talking about naturalism and supernaturalism. Naturalism and supernaturalism. Hang on to your hats. It's going to be a fast run through a lot of philosophy. But I think you'll find it interesting. Some of it you will have had before, so you'll be a little bit familiar with it at least. I'd like to talk first about the importance of presuppositions. A presupposition is an idea where you begin your thinking. A presupposition is an idea, usually a view of reality or a view of the universe or something like that, where you begin your thinking. As Christians, our presupposition is the idea of a personal, non-dependent God. Personal, non-dependent God. Okay, now when you're talking about, when you're dealing with people and you're talking on the level of presupposition, you have to listen past the person's question and hear what the person is not saying. You have to hear what the person is thinking. And so when you're reading something, when you're listening to someone, when you're witnessing, you must listen to what the person is thinking, not read their minds, but you must hear what is behind the statement that the person is making. If someone says, oh, I can't believe in the resurrection of Jesus, why not? Because dead people don't get raised from the dead. Okay. What is the person saying that the person is not saying? The person is saying that he really doesn't believe in anything as supernatural as God, such that something like resurrection from the dead could take place. Really what he's telling you is his view of reality. He's not just saying he doesn't believe in the resurrection. Okay? Okay, and or miracles. If a person says, oh, I don't believe miracles take place, what is the person telling you? He's telling you about his view of reality. I was recently sharing with a man some of the miracles that I had seen happen, some of the multiplication of food, water, oil, petrol, a lot of different things that I'd seen, people that had been healed, who'd gotten up on a wheelchair, just that kind of thing. And as I was sharing with him the miracles that I had seen, I shared with one of them with him, and he said, Michael, he said, I believe that you really experienced that. And I said, yeah. And he said, but I don't believe it happened. Now, what is he saying that he's not saying? He's saying that he views the universe totally apart from the supernatural. He's saying that he views the universe as only natural causes, with no possibility for the intervention of the supernatural into the natural order. That's what he's saying. See? What he was basically saying was, I believe you had a hallucination, Michael. See? You experienced that, but it didn't happen. In other words, it was a hallucination. I could have asked him, on the basis of his presupposition, how he was going to determine what was hallucination and what was real. But we didn't want to get into that. He could see that I was hurt, because I had been trying to develop a sensitive, open relationship with this guy, as one of the leaders of the gay community, actually one of the major leaders in the gay community in San Francisco. And I'd been trying to develop a relationship with him, and he could see that I was hurt. And I wanted him to see that I was hurt by what he said. And he said, Michael, you're hurt. And I said, yes, I am. He said, why are you hurt? And I said, because you just called me a liar, that's why. And he said, no, I didn't call you a liar. I just said that I didn't think that actually happened. I said, yes, the problem is that you're saying that you don't trust my judgment, so you're calling me a liar. What you're saying. I communicated something that was untrue. And not understanding the whole idea of forgiveness and whatever, we just sort of worked around that, because he wasn't about to ask me to forgive him for any such thing. So we had to work around it. But you see, a person can be saying something that they're not really saying. And so you have to listen. What is the person saying that the person is not saying? Or when you're reading. There's a guy on television in the United States. I don't know if you probably don't have him here, but as a broadcaster. He thinks presuppositionally. And it is so fascinating to see a news broadcaster think presuppositionally because he interviews people. Okay? And when the Argentina, Britain thing came on about the Falkland Islands, when it very, just before the war broke out, when it very, very first tension started to mount. He had a member of parliament, and he had the Argentine representative in the UN on together on the program. And he was asking the member of parliament, Britain, said, it appears as if some 100 years ago or whatever, that you took the island from Argentina by force. He said, and may I ask what the difference is now? That if they take the islands from you by force, what difference does it make? And all the guy could say was, it's the 20th century now, but you could see very, very clearly that didn't answer the question. Okay? And it was because the guy, Ted Koppel, was thinking presuppositionally. Okay? And so he was getting at the roots of some issues. What is the basic thing about force and taking things from other people? Is there any right and wrong in that? You think? And it was quite a delight to watch him. He tore into Indira Gandhi when he let her have it, boy. Anyway, we'll get into that. So when you're talking with somebody and the person says, well, I don't believe that the Bible is God's word. I don't think that it's a revelation of God's mind to us. The question is, what is the person actually saying? Is the person simply saying, I don't believe the Bible is God's word? Or are they saying something more profound about their view of reality? Maybe they really believe there is no God, so that there's no such thing as God to communicate through man to man in a communication like Scripture. Okay? Now, your presuppositions, your ideas that you start your thinking with, will limit the conclusions that you draw. It will limit the conclusions that you draw, but that does not mean necessarily you can say automatically from a presupposition that a person will reach this conclusion. There are certain conclusions you cannot reach given certain presuppositions, such as given the idea that there are only natural causes in a closed system in the universe, you cannot conclude that a supernatural event has taken place. You can't do that. You cannot conclude that a supernatural event has taken place when you have no supernatural in your presupposition. Your presupposition has defined that right out of existence for you. Okay? The idea? No, you don't. If a person says that all that there is in the universe is matter and energy, and chance operating within the system of matter and energy, when you say, I saw a person get up out of a wheelchair, and I saw them completely whole, the person must conclude that it was a natural event. There is no space in the person's presupposition for something like a supernatural event having taken place. And so the person must say, well, it must have been something natural that has taken place. Okay, so it does not necessarily conclude what conclusion the person will come to. Because you are a supernaturalist, it does not mean that you will automatically conclude that that was a natural event. Okay? The naturalist cannot conclude that it was a supernatural event. But it does not mean necessarily because you're a supernaturalist that you will conclude that it was a supernatural event. You understand? You may conclude, looking at the circumstances, you may conclude that it was actually psychosomatic. That the reason that the person wasn't walking was because of some psychological problem. And the reason the person got up and started walking was because something psychologically had taken place. You see? But not something supernatural. Okay, so a little difference there. We'll see that more clearly later when we talk about the prongs of the presupposition. They will define the limits of your conclusions, and when you're talking with people, you have to find out first, what is the person's presupposition? Or you're going to spend a lot of time dealing with people on peripheral issues rather than getting straight to the heart of the issue. A fellow in Hollywood, I was talking to a guy having a continual week by week of discussion. I met him every Friday at the bus stop. We were there witnessing on the street and he was there catching his bus going home from work. And so I started this conversation with Peter and we continued it week after week. And for a couple of weeks, we talked about his ideas of God and so forth. And then it became pretty clear after a couple of weeks that he was trying to mix Buddhism and Christianity. And so, one week when we were talking about Buddhism and Christianity, I said, really, since Buddha said that he didn't know whether there was a God or not, he actually thought there wasn't a God. Basically an atheist. And Christianity says that there is a personal, non-dependent God who's a spiritual being, and he actually exists. Then the only way that you can be putting those two together in your head is that you believe that there are no absolutes. You actually follow a relativistic line of thought, don't you? And he said, yes. And that was where the whole conversation broke open, and I was able to really put the gospel into his life, was on the point of absolutes and non-absolutes. What we did was, after building a little bit of friendship, which took a few weeks because I only saw him a little bit every week, building a little bit of friendship, then we were able to get to the heart of the issue, which was not Buddhism and Christianity, but relativism. The idea that he said he viewed the universe as non-absolute. See, that's the problem with the person that's involved in Baha'i. What is the problem with Baha'i? It is not that they're trying to put a whole bunch of religions together, but that the only way they can do that is if they are relativists. Religions that say that there is no God, another religion that says that God is an infinite impersonal force, another religion that says that God is an infinite personal being, you see, another religion that says that God is a dualistic system of good and evil together, see, another system that says that God is only good and there is no evil in his being. Trying to put all those together into one religion, see, doesn't work unless you're a relativist, unless you believe in no absolute. So really, what do they believe in? They believe in religious experience. You see? And anybody's religious experience is as good as anybody else's because there are no absolutes. And then, after you get behind all the Western garb of Baha'i, then you get down to the Islam, which is really what it is. Okay? It's garbed with a whole bunch of other kinds of Western relativism, but really when you get down to it, it is Islam. Okay. Huh? No, it's Islam. Oh yeah, it's Islam. Yes. Abdul Baha'u'llah was a prophet like Muhammad. Okay. Another prophet of Allah. Yeah, so their presentation is very very slick. You see? When you get right down to it, it is Islam. So they're being very deceptive. I believe they are being very deceptive. I must say that or you won't be able to sell this tape. Really, get sued. Yes. Where do we get our presuppositions? Most of them, most of us catch them, as Francis Schaeffer says, as we do the measles. We pick up our presuppositions from other people around us. We are taught a way of looking at the universe when we are growing up. And depending on the culture, the society, the part of the society, the subculture that we are raised in, that will determine the kind of way that we look at society. The way we look at the universe, our presupposition. Unless there is some kind of an intrusion into our culture and our society, such as a person may be a Buddhist and raise a Buddhist, but then somebody comes and preaches the gospel to them and they may adopt, when they were a teenager, may adopt Christianity and see that it's the truth. Okay? Then the person's presuppositions change by choice. So we get them from other people. We pick them up from them. Mostly, we pick them up by the conclusion that other people have reached. We aren't usually taught the presuppositions themselves, but we get them from the conclusions, such as naturalism. We usually pick up from things like evolution, or materialism, or communism. We are not usually taught naturalism straight out. What we're usually taught is evolution. And the only way you can propose evolution is if there is no God in the universe to deal with. And so you're automatically being taught naturalism along with being taught evolution. When you're taught evolution, that life has come about by chance on the earth, you're also being taught a presupposition. You're being taught a way of looking at the universe. Okay? And most of the way that we're taught history, literature, science, almost all the way that we're taught that, it presupposes naturalism. And so we're taught that by conclusions, mostly. We're also taught by attitude from other people, especially from our parents. And then teachers in school have an effect on us, too. But, for instance, I was taught very frequently, money doesn't grow on trees, you know, and whatever you get, you're going to have to work for. Now, what does that teach you about the universe? That there is no God that can provide supernaturally. So I was being taught a view of the universe. I was being taught, that's what that's called, is a cosmology. I was being taught a particular presupposition by the conclusions that were being taught to me. Okay? Or excuse me, by the conclusions and by the attitude that was being communicated. Another attitude that taught me a view of the universe was when my parents would worry about where the food was going to come from or whether or not my dad would have a job. My dad was, my real dad was a tile setter and by trade. And so if he didn't get jobs, we didn't have money. And it depended on where he, you know, where he went and whether or not he found a big job, like putting the tile in a whole motel or putting in a swimming pool or something like that, you see. Little ones just wouldn't keep us going as a family. And believe it or not all Americans are rich people. I had to work picking strawberries during the summer so that I could have clothes to wear to school during the year. So by attitude, I picked up from my parents that you couldn't always trust that there would be a God who would take care of you. But I've met one really lovely woman, and she and her husband are very good friends, and she was not taught by attitude. She was not taught that. She was taught exactly the opposite by her parents. She was raised in a family of 12 children. There were 14 of them altogether. And dad was a farmer. This is in Canada. And dad was a farmer, and they very often had hard times, especially if a crop failed or there wasn't enough sales of wood or something like that. They also did logging. And the parents never let the children know when there was a problem with food. Never let the children know. And so what would happen is the kids would come in and go, "What's for dinner?" You know, in the middle of the afternoon. And the mother would say, "Well, the Lord is going to surprise us again tonight, just like he did last night. Won't that be great?" And many times they were going from one meal to the next. As far as food was concerned for the family. But they never told the children that they didn't know where the food was going to come from. They always said, "Well, the Lord will surprise us with the next meal, just like he did with the last one." Okay? And the food was always there. And she said, then her parents later told her that they'd go away into the bedroom and go, "Oh, God, please." No. But they never told the kids that, see? And so later, when she had four kids of her own, which I don't know if they have any more right now or not, but the husband wanted to stop at four. She wanted to have 12, but he wanted to stop at four. She liked big families, see? But she never learned how to worry about food. She never learned it. And so whenever the family got into a crunch, she would go, "Oh, well, God will just have to surprise us with the next meal." That was what she learned by attitude from her parents. She learned that you can always trust God. He will take care of you. So she learned a view of the universe by the attitude of her parents. And we sometimes are taught by direct teaching. In school, Christian presuppositions are not usually taught, and very often the opposite are naturalism or evolution or existentialism or materialism or something like that. In France, it's very common for high schools to teach existentialism as a way of life, as an actual way of living. That's the way man lives. And so sometimes we are taught presuppositions in school that are wrong. Usually what happens is the Christian presupposition is not, so that people won't accept the Christian presupposition, and then they're very subtly taught by the conclusions, they're taught other presuppositions. But we've all been infected. We've all been infected with some kind of presupposition or another. Hopefully you were raised in a Christian home, went to Christian schools. If your parents were led by the Lord to send you to Christian school, that's a matter of specific guidance. But hopefully you were raised in such a way that your presuppositions are all in wonderful condition. However, most of us were not raised that way. And so God is in the great process of trying to get the fuzzy, unbiblical presuppositions out of our heads so that we can learn to respond to the way reality really is. Now, I don't mean by that we're always going to assume that something is supernatural. Okay? When my when you're driving along in the car and your car breaks down, I don't automatically try to seek God and see if I've sinned and that kind of stuff. I think that's a bit extreme to think that something supernatural has happened every time an event takes place. Floyd McClung was zipping down the freeway one time and tried to take a turn after he was past it. Totaled the car. Fortunately, everybody got out. Nobody was hurt. He had to walk home. And he was praying that night and said, God, what are you trying to teach me? And God said, I'm not trying to teach you anything. I had absolutely nothing to do with that. God said, you tried to take a turn after you were past it. That was your fault, not mine. Don't blame me for that. Okay. We sometimes over-spiritualize things because we're supernaturalists. I do not mean that. But what I do mean is that when we are faced with a situation where the supernatural is in order, that we should assume that something supernatural can happen. Okay? But many of us do not assume that. And so we run into all kinds of problems, especially with our faith. Especially believing that God will do something, he has to come through on something, that we can't see any possible way that he could come through with that. Okay? Such as provision. But sometimes we get a little ahead of God, you know, we want him to answer right away. And I better not talk about guidance right now. It seems like everybody's going through that right now. I better not get into that. You know. But God, my leaders need to know. What if God's not talking? Okay, so we've all been infected. I knew the leaders wouldn't like that. That's why I decided not to get into it. Leaders, whether you like it or not, sometimes God doesn't talk when you want him to. I didn't hear any amen. He's choking. Yeah, you've got to conclude it. But I have found, being a leader for numbers of years, that God didn't always talk to the people that were under me when I wanted them, God to talk to them, nor when they wanted God. They were going, God, talk to me. And I was going, God, talk to him. And God talked to him when he got good and ready to. Okay? So, yes, and we very often later saw the wisdom in all of that. Okay. Later, yes, later. Okay, so we've all been infected with these presuppositions, and God is trying to get them out of our head. Normally at this point I would give you a few examples of how I've seen food multiplied and that kind of stuff, but I won't do that. The thing is, we need to learn to respond to those kind of situations where it's really good being the head of a YWAM kitchen. You know, for a while I've been the head of three of them and various lengths of time. And it's really good to be in a YWAM kitchen because there are times when you simply have to see a miracle happen. You know, and there aren't any natural options open to you. And so, actually, one time God put me in a position where, by guidance, put me in a position where there weren't any natural options open to me, and I had to expect a miracle, and it came through. That was really wonderful of God to do that. But anyway, God is trying to get those fuzzy, naturalistic presuppositions out of our heads and get us to respond to the truth. Now, let's take a look at the two major presuppositions. There are two major ways that you can look at the universe. One is a naturalistic view. Do you call naturalism? And the other one is supernaturalism. Sup-nat. Okay. Naturalism is the idea that everything in the universe is in a system of that is completely closed and only natural causes work within it. In other words, the universe is all that there is and it is a completely closed system. A bit of a lopsided universe there, but... And inside this system, there are only natural causes that are working upon the matter and energy that is inside the system. It's a closed circle, and the reason it's closed is that there is no possibility for the supernatural to operate into the system. Not speaking spatially now, but speaking as a matter of concept. That within the system itself, all there is matter and energy, And there is no possibility for a supernatural to operate within that system, suspending anything, reordering anything, stopping any kind of natural processes, because there is no supernatural. Okay, so you can see naturalism is automatically atheistic, unless you want to define matter and energy as God, which is what a lot of naturalists end up doing. They say that matter and energy is God. Okay? So then there is no possibility of intervention from the outside into the natural order of cause and effect, basically, in the universe. So naturalism says that the universe is all that there is, and it's only matter and energy, and only chance operates within the system. It's not open to supernatural intervention. Supernaturalism looks like this. It says that the universe is an open system. That is, that the universe can be, the natural causes within the universe can be reordered, suspended, changed, whatever, by intervention from the supernatural realm. Okay? Now, spatially, this looks like it's outside, but... Okay? The idea is that the supernatural can operate into the natural, affecting the natural causes that are going on in the universe. And so it is, in essence, it's a more complicated system, the supernatural, because it involves two ideas rather than one. Now, they are similar, these pictures are similar, in that both of them contain natural causes, both of them contain matter and energy. Both of them are concerning the universe. That's how they're similar. They are different in that in one case you have only natural causes, and in the other case you have supernatural and natural causes. I usually hear that when I'm teaching this. One time everybody did it all at the same time. You hear it all over the room. Putting their little dots in. The dots here and the dots there are supposed to be the same, but I don't bother trying to make them the same. I don't think you will either. Okay, so you see the difference then? This is basically a one-pronged presupposition. All that there is natural causes in a completely closed system. This one is a two-pronged system. You've got natural causes and you've got supernatural causes. And you have to figure out, as a Christian who happens to be a scientist, you would have to figure out concerning any event that you observe, any phenomenon that you observe, you will have to include the supernatural, the possibility of the supernatural, in your observations. It's very difficult to do that. It makes scientific process very complicated process. Okay? Now, let me give you some examples of naturalism. These are some naturalistic philosophies. Some of them you'll see right away. Some of them you won't. Materialism, the naturalistic philosophy. Materialism is naturalistic. Evolution is naturalistic. Communism is naturalistic. Buddhism, naturalistic. Hinduism, naturalistic. Now the last two are a little bit more difficult to see. But whether you start with the idea that everything is God, and that's all that there is, or you start out with the idea that God is all that there is, and therefore the universe must be God, either way, you end up with the universe being basically what is. That's the only thing you can have knowledge of. The only thing that you could have knowledge of as a person. Because you have to have some kind of revelation from a mind greater than your own finite mind to conclude it. And there isn't a revelation. There isn't such a revelation given. Now, I know that they will claim that there are revelations like that, but it's very easy to shoot it down as far as being a revelation from the mind of God. When I was in San Francisco this last summer, June through August, our summer, I was talking to a young guy named Philip. And he didn't say where he was coming from philosophically to start with. He was 19. didn't say where he was coming from philosophically, but as we talked, we discussed the issue of whether or not there was a possibility of revelation from a mind such as the mind of God to man, so that man wasn't using only his own finite mind to try to figure out what was going on in the universe. And we came to the conclusion that humanism was bankrupt because if man with only his finite mind could not conclude anything that was absolute, then man had to have some kind of revelation from a mind greater than his to try to conclude absolutes, or to know that there were absolutes. Consequently, if there is no revelation from something like the mind of God, if the Bible is not that revelation, we're pretty well sunk. And we went through things like the Bhagavad Gita, the Tripitaka, the Upanishads, we went through those things, and the Rig Vedas, and we discussed why those kinds of things would not be revelation from the mind of God. And then later on, after he had agreed with me that there had to be some kind of revelation from a mind greater than the finite mind of man, then later he told me that he was basically, he believed in karma. And he gave me a textbook definition of karma. I mean, he really believed in karma. And after he had given me this wonderful exposition of karma and had told me that he believed in karma, I said, well, Philip, on the basis of what revelation from a mind greater than your own finite mind have you come to the conclusion that that is the way the universe is? And he just gave me this little knowing grin. He knew he was sunk. He didn't have an answer. You see? And he knew it, and he admitted it. You see? Unless he had something greater than his own finite mind to draw upon, then there was no reason why I should say that his philosophy was true, because he couldn't conclude it absolutely. Okay, so you've got Buddhism, Hinduism. You can think about those things and see how they work out into naturalism. But very often, the naturalistic presupposition is mystified. That is, the person attaches personal qualities to the natural. The person attaches personal qualities to the natural, when the natural really does not have those qualities. You ever seen nature called Mother Nature? Okay. Why is nature called Mother Nature? Because people can't stand the idea that they've come from an absolutely impersonal source. Because then they know that they really have no significance. So they can't stand it. Okay. So they mystify the presupposition. Or, for instance, I was talking to a guy, to a Hare Krishna fellow in Seattle. And as we talked, he was bringing out all of his philosophy about God being energy and that kind of stuff. And then later he said, isn't it wonderful that God is merciful towards us? And I said, well, that doesn't really fit with what you said before, because now you're saying God has personal qualities. Are you saying God is a person, or are you saying God is an infinite impersonal life force? What are you saying? And he really, they're very hard to talk to, really, because they have both things squashed together in their heads. And I had to try to help him sort out the difference between the infinite impersonal and the infinite personal. And he had them all squashed together in his head. Makes it very, very difficult. But one thing that they're all involved in, all naturalists are involved in, is that they must say that matter is eternal. In one way or another, they've got to say matter is eternal. Either matter is a part of God because it is God, such as in Hinduism, and therefore it's eternal because God will always be moving in different cycles of creation and destruction. Or the evolutionist will have to say that matter has always existed because he cannot explain how something came from nothing. And so he will probably say that matter has always existed. If they're really honest, they may say something like, well, we can't tell where everything has come from, but it must have come from somewhere, if they're really honest with their science. Okay, but usually they will say that matter is eternal. Now let us consider the idea that matter is eternal. Okay? If anything now exists, then something is eternal, or something finite arose from nothing. You only really have two alternatives. I'll say that again so you can get it. If anything now exists, we have to assume, you see, that things exist. We can't prove that to start out with. You must assume certain things. If anything now exists, which you cannot assume, you have to state it that way. If anything now exists, then something is eternal. You're not saying what the nature of that something is, but something is eternal. Or something finite arose from nothing. Got that? That leaves you with four major choices concerning the universe. Number one, the universe can be eternal. It is only matter and energy. Only chance operates within it. And that's the nature of the universe. It's eternal, consists of only matter and energy, and only chance operates within the system. Okay, that's the first thing. We'll come back and talk later about problems with these. Okay? Number two, the universe is an illusion. If you say, if anything now exists, then one of the possibilities is an illusion. Everything is an illusion. Not very many people propose this, but some do. There are problems with it, of course, saying everything is an illusion. There are great problems with it. The biggest problem is that you can't honestly say it without concluding that something is not an illusion. Okay? Or assuming that something is not an illusion. Number three, something spontaneously arose from nothing. The whole universe spontaneously arose from nothing. Not very many people propose that either. See? If they propose something like that, something finite arose from nothing, then they've got to explain the factors involved in such a production. Okay? We wouldn't hold them to explaining the source or proving that it did actually take place, but they would have to give some kind of explanation as to the process involved. We cannot explain creation. We weren't there, were we? We weren't there. There's no way we can observe it. Scientifically, we can't prove that kind of thing. We'll get to that in a little while, but the thing is, we can explain the process because our presupposition does explain the process. That there is a God, like the God of the Bible, can include the idea, that he could speak a word and make something like the universe, if you really have the kind of God that is described in the Bible as a presupposition. Okay. But we cannot conclude, therefore, that creation ever would take place or did so take place. Only the possibility is there, and the function, presuppositionally. Number four is the universe could be finite and created by some transcendent force. The universe could be finite and created by some transcendent force. Okay, now, number one, the universe is eternal, it's only matter and energy, and only chance operates within the system. Your big problem is science. Your big problem is the universe, because the universe itself does not tell you that kind of a story. Now, this will shorten things greatly tonight if I can find out from you, have you had teaching through Winky or through, you know, whatever, have you had teaching on the problems with the second law of thermodynamics? You haven't had it. Okay. Some of you have. But if you haven't all had it, then we need to go through it. Okay? Did you really? Some say yes. There was a videotape. Okay, then some of you don't have this. Okay? There is the second law of thermodynamics. The first law is commonly stated like this, that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. But that, of course, is from whose point of view? Is that true? Matter can neither be created nor destroyed? No, not true. Doesn't make any difference if you're speaking of the finite. Makes no difference whatsoever. The point is, it's looking at it from a human point of view. As far as human beings are concerned, they can't make either one. They can't destroy either one. But the point is, God can. Doesn't make any difference. Okay? And yet we commonly swallow that when we're in science class. And what does it do? It teaches us a view of the universe. Doesn't it? Teaches us a view of the universe. There is no such thing as a God that can deal with matter and energy in that fashion. Okay, that's the first law, but the second law deals with a process which is called entropy. The idea of entropy is a negative idea, and so you have to get your mind sort of in gear for this. You have to think backwards. The idea of entropy is that in any particular finite system, the amount of energy that is available for work that will usually be involved in some kind of order, some kind of complexity, the amount of energy that is available for work is constantly decreasing. It is constantly decreasing, the amount of energy that is available for work. And when the available energy is decreasing, what you say is the entropy is rising. If you want to think of it this way, randomness or lack of ability to do work is entropy. That is an increase in the randomness, a decrease in the order, and thus also a decrease in the available energy for work. Okay? So given any particular finite system, the entropy within the system is always increasing, which means what? It's becoming more and more random. There's less and less order. Okay? And so there is less energy available for work. Got that? Okay. Now, the problem then is like this. If you have a finite system, how long does it take for a finite system to reach what is called heat death or total entropy? It's called total entropy. Total entropy, can't spell while I'm talking. Total entropy would be when there is no more energy available for work, or a state of total randomness with no design, no order, no energy available for work. It would be like chocolate pudding. Okay? Total entropy, or sometimes called heat death, because work is expressed through heat. Okay, heat death or steady state. It's called those three things. Steady state. Okay? How long in a finite system does it take, don't be complicated with this now, how long in a finite system does it take for a system to reach heat death? Huh? Don't be complicated. How long? How long? Oh, come on, you're being too complicated. What's that? Until you run out, yes, but how long is that? No. I haven't told you how big the system is. How long does it take a finite system to run out of energy? A finite amount of time. Be too complicated with it, see? Okay? Finite? Finite. So how long would it take for an infinite system to reach heat death? An infinite amount of time. May I ask, if matter has always existed, how long has it had to run down? May I ask then why the universe has not yet reached heat death? Why there is so much available energy in the universe? Why there is so much order and design complexity? And if somebody says it's so big that it hasn't run down yet, the word yet presupposes a beginning to the running down. What do you mean, yet? Are you saying there was a beginning to the running down? What do you mean by yet? It's had enough time, has it not? Always been running down. You can't say it hasn't run down yet. Because you're pushing it back to a finite beginning then of the running down.
Are you thinking? Are you breathing? When you say that the universe has always existed, how long has it existed? Always. An infinite amount of time, right? Okay. So how long does it take for an infinite system to run down? An infinite amount of time. Why hasn't it run down yet? Why hasn't it reached heat death? When you say yet, if a person says it's so big that it hasn't run down yet, then that presupposes a beginning to the running down. In their minds, they are presupposing a beginning. Because from this point where we are now, back, eternity past, there has been enough time for it to reach heat death. Why isn't it at heat death now? You see? And when the person says it hasn't run down yet, you say, well, what do you mean? There hasn't been enough time? In an eternal amount of time, there hasn't been enough time? You can't say that, see? When the person says yet, they're saying there hasn't been enough time yet. That's what they're saying, for it to run down. And so when the person says yet, you need to note that, because they're telling you something. Most people won't even notice that they're doing that. And you have to tell them, okay, what they're actually saying. Well, wait a second. When you say yet, you're presupposing a beginning to the running down. And we're not presupposing any beginning to the running down, because you said that the universe is eternal. You said that matter was eternal. Okay, so that's a problem. There's a rebuttal to that. It goes like this. The universe, this is what an unbeliever could say in return, the universe actually may be pulsating in its energy levels. And you see this coming out rather interestingly. You see this coming out in science fiction a lot.
The universe is going like this. At one point, there was no available energy for work. Everything was a heat death. For some strange reason, unknown to us, the energy level started rising. And it rose until it reached a peak, which in a lot of theories would be the Big Bang. Okay? It reached a peak, went boom, did something or other, and then suddenly started expanding instead of contracting, and the energy level started going downhill. Here we are in a history of our universe. I mean, history of the creation as we know it, okay? There it is. Human life, that long. History of the universe. And then, after human life is gone, this will decrease and decrease until it reaches heat death again. And then, for some strange reason, it will start going up again, okay? Until it reaches another Big Bang, and then it goes back down. This, by the way, is the basic Chinese view of God. Anyway, the circle is going on and on and on. But when this rises up like this, and this goes down over here, let me ask, scientifically speaking, what does scientific process start with? What's the first step? Who said it? What'd you say? No, somebody said it over here. That's right. Observation. The first step of scientific process.
You have to observe something. There has to be a phenomenon first.
You have to observe something taking place. According to scientific principle, then, can you say that the universe ever did run up hill? No, because we, according to all the best observations we can make right now, everything is running down. And it would be totally philosophy, totally assumption, to assume that it ran uphill at one point. Right? That would be all that there would be. That's all it could be, is philosophy, that it ran uphill at one point. And if we, as Christians, did not have a revelation from the mind of God such as the Word of God, we would be sunk in the same position. Because even if God spoke to us personally and said,
I created the world.
You see, if we had nothing other than the subjective revelation on which to base our ideas of the universe, we would be in the same position. We would not be able to conclude where the universe has come from. We wouldn't be able to do that. But we've received revelation from the mind of God that a certain thing has taken place in the past, and that is that God did create things. And in essence, everything was running uphill at one point, but that was because God, from his being, was putting energy into the whole system. God was speaking, God was moving, God did things, the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the water, God spoke and said, let this happen, and things. And so things were coming out of chaos and into order, for the earth was without form and void, and God started putting things together into order, which is from a higher state of entropy to a lower state of entropy, because of the input of God. Okay? You got that? Didn't do it by itself. It did it because there was energy coming into the system from the being of God. He was doing it. He was moving. He was speaking. Okay. And so, left to itself, from the time that man sinned, it could have been from the time that God finished creating. When it says he rested, it could be that what it meant by resting was not that he was exhausted, because I don't think it really exhausted him. Okay? I don't think there's any entropy in God's being, so that it wouldn't have exhausted him. But what it means by he rested was he stopped putting all of this energy into the system. And then it speaks something more, much more of the creation than it does of God. It tells us more about that. And so then the system then would have started in a system of entropy, would have started going to lower and lower levels of energy. It could be that everything originally was supposed to stay in store as it was, and only after man sinned did things start going towards a state of entropy. There are different ways of looking at it, and we can't conclude conclusively what the way that would be. Okay? I'm not exactly sure how you would have digestion take place in a perfect state without entropy taking place. Who knows? Okay. Now, let's go on. So that's a rebuttal that you could give, but the thing is, there's no way that the scientist can go back 10 billion years or whatever he needs to do to observe some entropy happening the opposite direction. Things going to a lower and lower state of entropy. Nor can he go ahead into the future to observe that from where we are. So, in other words, scientifically, the person cannot say anything like that. Scientifically, all we can say right now is according to the best things we can observe in the universe, everything is running down, going downhill as far as energy is concerned. And so that is what we must work with scientifically. And if a person postulates a pulsating universe, the burden of proof is on them to show that entropy can actually be reversed in that fashion. It would be very difficult for them to prove that. If anybody does prove that, they'll win themselves a Nobel Prize for sure. Okay? So then, you will have done them a favor. Number two, the idea that everything is an illusion. Not too many people postulate this, but it is postulated by some people sometimes. The problem with it is that in order to postulate it, you must violate it. When you say that everything is an illusion, you have assumed that at least two things are not an illusion, you and your thoughts. Because if you also are an illusion, and your thoughts are an illusion, there is no reason to accept your conclusion as true. You understand? So if a person says everything is an illusion, they have assumed that their thoughts are not an illusion, and that they are not an illusion, in order to conclude that everything is an illusion. But if they are an illusion, then you can ask them, that means you're an illusion too, is that not right? Yes, I'm an illusion too. Then why should I trust, or why should you trust, your conclusion, since you're an illusion and your thoughts are an illusion? How can you tell they're true? And they will have no basis on which to say that those things are true. And so, but if a person really wants to push that presupposition, they can really push it out to the end. And so what I do then is I start applying reality. They say everything is an illusion. I say, then why do you continue to eat food? Why do you continue to come through the door rather than coming through the wall? Why do you sit down on chairs and expect that the chair will be there by the time you get there? Or it'll still be there? Aren't you a little afraid sometimes the chair might not be there? Because it's an illusion? They don't live that way. They can't live that way. And so you can take reality and press it upon them. I like what Winky did. He grabs their nose, starts to twist. And when they say, stop that, that hurts, he goes, no, it can't hurt. That's an illusion. And also, this is not a nose, it's a banana. Okay, so number three, you could say that the universe spontaneously arose from nothing. And I am not even going to try to talk about that. Because I have never met anybody. Very few, if any, people would ever try to say something arose from nothing. That's not only bad logic, it's bad grammar, too. I mean, it defies the definitions of the word something and nothing. So it's not only bad logic, it's also bad grammar to say that something spontaneously arose from nothing. Nothing? Something? I mean, what do those words mean by the time you get finished? To say that something arose from nothing is to postulate that nothing is a something. See the problem? Okay. Number four is the universe could be finite and made by some transcendent force. Now, we can't exactly conclude what kind of force that would be, but we know that entropy would not operate in its being, so it would have to be of a different nature. It would have to be non-material, which is one of the strongest arguments that God is spirit. And when the Bible says that God is spirit, it makes sense philosophically, because if entropy operates in God's being, then he would be under the system of entropy too. Why hasn't he run down? Why hasn't he reached peak death? And so the thing from which the creation has come would have to itself not be of the same nature that the creation is. So when God reveals to us that he is spirit, okay, it makes sense, because he'd have to be something else so that those laws do not operate in his own being. Okay, I'm not going to go into my things concerning scientific process. I won't have the time to do that. You should talk about scientific process and how unscientific it is. Okay. I'll say a couple of things about miracle, probably. Now, most of the time, you won't deal with that too much. Let me say something to you about scientific process. Scientific process is based on the probability of X. Whether or not X will take place, given a certain cause, will you have this particular effect? And it is based, first of all, on observation. You must observe something taking place. Then you can start working on your hypotheses and postulates and all that kind of stuff. But first you must observe something that is taking place. There is a problem, however, and that is that when you have observed something, it is automatically past. Is it not? To make a statement about something that you have observed, it must be a past situation. And so science can only make statements about the past. But what science tries to do is make statements about the future. And when it does so, it steps totally outside of the realm of science. Like this. You can observe something taking place a number of times. And you can say, X happened here, X happened there, given this cause, X happened there, given the same cause, X happened there, and there, and there, and there, and there, and there, and there. Then on the basis of the number of times that X has happened in the past, they try to postulate whether or not X will happen the next time. The problem with that is that they are then not working on the basis of scientific observation, because observation always deals with only the past. If they were dealing on the basis of scientific observation, they would have to say, we don't know whether or not X will happen when we do this again. We would have to do it and find out. And if it does, then we can say, yes, that is what has happened. You get the idea? When the scientist goes from the past to the future, he is depending not upon scientific process, but he is depending upon an innate understanding that things should continue as they have been. In other words, he's depending upon what he, as a human being, intuitively senses about the fitness of the universe. That things should remain as they have been. There is nothing in the nature of the universe that tells you that that is the case. It is totally a human function, and it goes totally outside of the realm of science. Only if there is a mind behind the universe, such as the mind of God, which is, our minds are in essence like his, only if there is a mind behind the universe that is somewhat like ours, could we ever say that we could expect the universe to go on as it has been. Because we sense that, and maybe the one who made the universe feels the same way, so he made it to be that way. Only if you have a mind behind the universe can you do scientific experimentation and say, I can make a law or a postulate about what will happen in the future. Otherwise, all you can say is that, well, I can only bring about the cause and see if it happens again. And if it doesn't happen, what is the only thing the scientist can do? Change his law. That's all he can do. Given the same cause, the only thing he can do is change his law. And you might say, couldn't he doubt that he did the experiment correctly? If he does doubt that he did the experiment correctly, he has reverted to the sense of fitness about the universe. I must have done something wrong because this shouldn't have turned out this way. Then he is not dependent upon scientific process, but upon what? Upon his sense of fitness concerning the universe. His scientific process tells him, no, it's not like that. His sense of fitness of the universe tells him, I must have done my experiment the wrong way. Because it didn't turn out right. Right. You see? What is he depending upon? Scientific process? No. Because he's not depending upon observation at that point. He's depending upon a sense of fitness in the universe that has been violated when something happens that shouldn't have happened, according to his law. You get the idea now? Okay? And so, what is the scientist depending upon? He's depending upon something that is above the natural, that is beyond the natural. He is depending upon the supernatural in order to be able to do his science. You cannot verify finite intention objectively. You cannot verify finite intention. In other words, the scientist made choices when he did his experiment, didn't he? He chose to pick up a test tube, move it from this place to that place. Right? Chose to turn on the burner, chose to heat up the chemical, and what was he doing that whole time? He was choosing, and his intention as a finite being can never be objectively verified. Could he ever prove that he actually made those choices? Couldn't do it. See? The scientist is involved in a lot of supernatural things in order to be able to do his science, and yet they don't want to allow us the possibility that there may be something supernatural, and they express it all the time, constantly. You say, well, can't the scientist show that his thoughts exist because of an electroencephalograph? Say, no, he can't. He can show that certain movements take place in the matter that is in his brain, but he can never say that that actually came from a thought. You can't make that connection. How about that? Okay? And so scientific process, the whole thing is based on some supernatural assumptions. And so when the scientist assumes those things in doing his work, which he never tells you about that, but when he is the naturalist, well, when he assumes those things, then why can't we assume that there might be something supernatural that is not human? He's going to assume that there are things that are supernatural. Why can't we? Okay? So it's just as valid for us to do that. In other words, to put it this way, the presence of finite reason in the universe is an indication of the supernatural. The presence of finite reason in the universe indicates the presence of the supernatural in the universe. Now David Hume, the philosopher, basically said this concerning miracles, and when you talk with most university students, you will deal with the argument that Hume gives, and it's like this. Now you're going to see very easily that this argument doesn't hold much water, but this is what most people will say to you. Number one, this is his argument against the supernatural. Number one, miracle is a violation of natural law. Miracle is a violation of natural law. We might quibble with Hume about the word violation, but in essence, that is what miracle is. It is a violation of natural law. It is a suspension, a reordering, a stopping, or whatever you want to call it. It's an intervention of the supernatural into the natural. And so natural law is affected in some way by miracle. Miracle is a violation of natural law. Number two, universal human experience shows that these natural laws are unalterable. Universal human experience shows that these natural laws are unalterable. Start to sense something suspicious right away. Number three, therefore, no miracle could have ever taken place. No miracle ever could take place. Since miracle is a violation of natural law, and these laws are unalterable, then no miracle could ever take place. The point is that you cannot assume number two. Number two is what? Universal human experience shows that the laws are unalterable. You cannot assume number two unless you prove number three empirically. See, the point is that people claim that miracles have taken place. That's the point. And until you can prove that no miracles have taken place, you can never say that universal human experience shows that the laws are unalterable. Because there are humans who are saying, no, that's not true. The laws all are alterable because I saw somebody get healed. Or I know that somebody was raised from the dead. Or something like that. People are saying that, and so you would have to investigate every case and come to the conclusion in every case, which the finite mind couldn't do, you see, come to the conclusion in every case that no miracle had taken place, and then you could conclude that universal human experience shows that these laws are unalterable. And then we would have to ask, is that necessarily a positive proof that they could not be altered by anything else? Okay, so that's the kind of argument you'll get, even though it's not really a very good argument. Now, let's talk about a tree. We have the naturalist and the supernaturalist out in the woods, and they're both watching a tree. Now, my tree, I know, my little tree is going to look very much like a mushroom. It usually does. But that's okay. Okay, here's my little tree out in the woods. Okay? If I put holes on that, it would look like a morel. It doesn't matter even if it's a mushroom. So they're out looking at a mushroom. Okay? It's just a little more dramatic if it's a tree. In this case, it happens to be a Christmas tree. Ah, okay. Now, or apple? No, it wouldn't be that safe with it. Okay, now the tree, the naturalist and the supernaturalist are out watching this tree. And suddenly, right before their very eyes, this tree falls over on the ground and you've got dead tree. And both the naturalist and the supernaturalist run over and they go, I wonder what could have caused this to take place. Now, the naturalist can only conclude one thing. They can only conclude that a natural event, something, some natural cause, has caused the tree to fall over. The supernaturalist has a little bit more of a problem, because he could say a natural cause has caused it to fall over, or he could say a supernatural cause has caused it to fall over. It does not say, however, that does not say which one he will conclude, because he must investigate, right? So as the naturalist and the supernaturalist are both looking at this tree, they see that the roots have been eaten by worms. Over a long period of time, the tree lost its root system and then probably suddenly fell over because it didn't have a root system anymore. Okay? And so the naturalist could say, aha, it appears as if it fell over because the roots were eaten by worms. And the supernaturalist would probably say, aha, it appears as if the tree fell over because its roots were eaten by worms. Concluded a natural cause. Because it was likely in that case that that was what happened. There seems to be good enough evidence that that was why the tree fell over. Now, if they are both looking at this tree, they're both standing there contemplating why this tree has fallen over, and suddenly the tree rises without any visible means of support, 6 feet off the ground, and is hovering in the air, the naturalist would still have to say there must be some kind of natural cause, some kind of explanation for this. The supernaturalist would probably look at it and go, it could be a natural cause. But it would seem more likely in this case, this is probably a supernatural event that is taking place. But see, there still has to be the possibility of natural cause. Quirk in gravity, some strange thing like that, you think. You know, gravity is different on different parts of the earth. You know, people come in out of the rain and they go, oh, the rain's horrible today, or, oh, the heat is awful today. They ever walk in and say, the gravity's horrible today. Nobody ever says that. You notice that? I notice that. Nobody ever complains about the gravity. Anyway, better not complain. I wouldn't want God to take the gravity away. That'd be a grave situation, wouldn't it? Situation filled with gravity. No. Awful. Anyway, so what I would probably do in that situation, by the way, as a supernaturalist, is I would rebuke first and ask questions later. Probably the first thing I would do, you see. If the tree suddenly rose off the ground by itself, I'd rebuke it first, and then I'd ask questions. Okay. Yeah. Probably after I rebuked it and it fell down, I'd go, what was your name? That's the question I'd ask. You unclean spirit, you. Okay, so then your conclusions from your presuppositions are basically fixed. You have a certain limit of conclusions you can reach. Okay? You cannot conclude just anything given a particular presupposition. However, which conclusion you will reach within the defined limits of your conclusions cannot be worked out until you have done some investigation. Okay, so then the naturalist, symbol of the naturalist philosophy, the naturalist then works down from his presupposition to certain conclusions. And given the naturalist's presupposition, the idea that there are only natural causes in the universe, can you see why he would say things like, the Bible is not a revelation from the mind of God? Because he can't conclude any such thing, because there isn't any God in his system. Okay? So he would have to say, no, the Bible is not God speaking through man to man. The Bible is man speaking about God to man. But it's totally a human function. Okay? Nothing supernatural about the Bible, because he cannot admit the supernatural. If it is God's word, then you're saying that it's supernatural, that there is a supernatural intervention in the history, and they will not admit that. Or resurrection, or the possibility of miracle. Totally excluded. Totally excluded. The virgin birth. Why do people have to contest that? They don't have to contest it because the word says young woman. They don't have to do that. What about the place where Mary says, how can this be, seeing I've never known a man? She was obviously stating that she was a virgin. Okay? And what about that? There's an interesting, can you call him a theologian? I don't know if you call him a theologian or not. I don't know exactly what to call him. I won't say his name because I always call him the wrong thing. I get his name mixed up and call him a derogatory term, so I won't say his name. But he said this. You're going through my head now. He says this, that what happened at the feeding of the 5,000 was that that when the little boy took out his lunch, it made everybody so ashamed that they weren't willing to share, and he was willing to share, that everybody brought out their lunches, and there was plenty of food for everybody, but they were all hiding it. Now, why would a guy even have to go to such lengths to try to deny the supernatural aspect of the scripture? Because he isn't a supernaturalist to start with. He's a naturalist. Okay? Why do people have to say that the healing at the Gate Beautiful was, I read this one time, why do they say that the healing at the Gate Beautiful was psychosomatic? Why do they have to do that? Why do they have to say that the casting out of demons was only Jesus dealing with psychological problems that the man had? You see, with the legion and casting out 2,000 demons into the pig? Why? Why do they have to say things like that? Because their presuppositions will not allow them any such conclusion. And so, with the limits of their conclusion, they have to say, this could not have happened in that way. Or as the guy said to me, yes, I believe that you experienced that, but it didn't happen. Okay. So let's talk then for a little while. I like to talk about this. Let's talk for a little while about one of the conclusions of naturalism, and that is evolution. I'm going to give you some of the things you need to think about. I've got, let's see, how many have I got here? I have 11 areas that you can think about concerning evolution, and it'll give you a little outline to get started on your study concerning it, if you haven't already started. Number one, evolution and creation have to do with origin. Origin, beginning, the beginning of things. They are both unprovable by nature. We cannot prove scientifically that creation has taken place. Why can we not prove scientifically that creation has taken place? No one was there. It can't be observed. It also has happened once. Not repeatable. And you have to have something that is observed that can happen more than once to fit inside the realm of scientific process. Okay? Another, and then as far as evolution is concerned, when they say evolution has taken place, well, it's really interesting that they say that it takes place over such a long period of time that no one human being can observe evolution actually taking place. At least that's what they used to say. Now what they say, under a fancy term called punctuated equilibrium, now what they're saying is, the general process of evolution is over long periods of time that no one can observe, but every now and then there will be these rapid-fire events that suddenly happen. Wham! And one thing changes to another thing. And that has happened so quickly that the intermediate forms will not be found in the fossil. You see? And so now it's happening so quickly that it's not observable and there's no evidence for it. See? But in both cases, what have they done? They have put it outside of the realm of science by putting it outside of the realm of observable evidence. See? Now we'll talk about what they try to use for observable evidence later, which is fossils, and see why those really don't prove evolution, but they prove creation, or indicate creation. Okay? And evidence for that. And the problem with past events is that they're in the historical realm, not the scientific realm, such as the resurrection of Jesus. Can you prove scientifically that Jesus was raised from the dead? No, of course not, because it's not even in the realm of science. It's in the realm of history. Now, historically, I can offer you quite a lot of evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead. Scientifically, I can't offer you any evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead. Period. Right? Got that? You can't offer scientific evidence that there was a day yesterday. You realize that? You can't offer scientific evidence that the sun ever came up yesterday. You can't do that. Because it's now a historical event. You can offer historical evidence that the sun rose yesterday by the people that observed it, 8 witnesses here. You can offer historical evidence because it was recorded what time it came up. People observed the rising of the sun, noted that it actually came up at the proper time it was supposed to come up, where it came up on the horizon. You can name all kinds of historical evidences, but not one scientific one. Why? Because you can't bring it back, make it happen again so that it can be observed to you as a person again. Can't do it. You got that? So yesterday was a historical event. It can never be proved scientifically. It can only be proved historically. And so the things like that which has happened in the past, the creation, resurrection of Jesus from the dead, those things can only be shown to be historically true. They cannot be shown to be scientifically true because they're not open to observation. You cannot observe yesterday happening again. Can't do it. Okay? It's like trying to observe that there is no God. People try to prove scientifically that there is no God. How can you observe the non-existence of a thing? It doesn't work. Okay, we'll get into that a little more next week. Is there or is there not a God? So all theories of origin are supernatural. All theories of origin are supernatural. They all include something that goes beyond the natural. For instance, something suddenly arose from nothing. That is obviously supernatural. As far as we know, something does not come from nothing. Something comes from something. Right? Second origin, idea of origin, is the Big Bang theory, which goes against entropy, as we have already seen, saying that entropy at one time was, that there was a lessening of entropy rather than an increase in entropy in the universe. as things contracted until they finally went into the Big Bang stage. The third one is the pulsating universe, which we've looked at. And that's supernatural, because it assumes that at one point entropy goes the opposite direction, and it will do so again in the future. So that is supernatural. And the fourth idea is creation. And that is supernatural. It assumes that there are principles that are greater than the natural that operated at one time. That at one time, nothing was, but a being named God made something with his word. So it ends up being what? A matter of faith. The point is, which presupposition are you going to start with? But once you have chosen a particular presupposition, you can't prove a presupposition, remember that. Once you have chosen a particular presupposition, then you have to see whether or not that presupposition fits the real world as it is. And if your presupposition constantly runs into problems with the real world, it may be some evidence, not proof, but it may be evidence that your presupposition may have some problems. But if your presupposition is consistent with the real world as it is, and you don't have to force the observable evidence into your system, then it may indicate that your presupposition is true. It will not prove it, because nothing becomes evidence until you've already presupposed a presupposition. Now, why do naturalists find creation so hard to believe? Why do they find it so incredible? It's because of their presupposition. That's why they find it incredible. It's not because there isn't scientific evidence for the idea of creation, but it's simply because they are committed to the idea that there is no supernatural. So when you start trying to offer evidence that there is a supernatural, that's why they find it incredible. Is that there's a supernatural at all, because they don't want to admit that. Now, the second point, first point was origin. Second point is uniformitarianism versus catastrophism. Uniformitarianism versus catastrophism, or I looked it up in the dictionary, I never could figure out whether to say catastrophism or catastrophism. I think it's catastrophism. Uniformitarianism. 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 Got that? Okay. If you did, you were fast. Uniformitarianism versus catastrophism, from the word catastrophe. Something happening suddenly. Violent event. Okay? Uniformitarianism is the idea that everything has been happening over long, long periods of time, billions of years. There have been natural processes that have happened in a uniform state. Natural processes that have happened in a uniform state so that the whole surface of the earth and the evidence that we find there, that we observe, all of that can be explained according to the principles that we now see operating in the world. Which, of course, there are many, many problems with that. There are lots of things they can't explain, but they will still say that it must have been a uniform principle, and they'll say that as a matter of faith, even without any evidence. Uniform, you get the idea? Uniformitarianism says that all of the surface of the earth and the way that it's like the strata in the rock with the fossils in it, all of the shapes of the land, such as mountains, valleys, where the oceans are, the way the continents are, can all be explained on the basis of the same principles that we see operating today. It can all be explained on the basis of that without any kind of a catastrophic event taking place. Okay? And as soon as you introduce the idea of the catastrophic into it, it changes the whole system. And so to say that every now and then a catastrophe may have taken place, a person is no longer involved in uniformitarianism. The catastrophic, on the other hand, catastrophism is basically the way the Bible portrays history. Is that it's a series of the world is as God created it, except that there have been a series of catastrophic events that have changed the surface of the earth, the most notable of which is the flood. Okay? But there are all kinds of other things. Seven major worldwide catastrophes are mentioned in the Old Testament. And there are very possibly many others that are mentioned, but we can't really conclude from them that they are worldwide. But there are statements that many of the, concerning seven of them, there are statements that they were worldwide. Worldwide. For instance, when, most of you probably don't realize this, that when Babylon came and captured Israel, there were things happening all around the world at the same time. Or when Sennacherib's army was destroyed by the death angel, you look at those cases and you will see that God says he's going to do something to the earth at that time, or to the world at that time. When the children of Israel came up from Egypt, and the plagues that took place, what did God say about it? That it happened to the earth. Okay. But we don't normally take that literally. And you know why we don't take that literally? We have evolution stuck in our head. That's why we don't take the Bible for what it says. Did you know that there are mountains in the world where the strata in the mountains are exactly backwards to the mountain range that's around them? And evolutionists have all kinds of fun trying to explain that kind of thing. Do you know how God explains it? He got angry. The Bible says he overturns the mountains in his wrath. He gets upset and goes, he overturns the mountains in his wrath. And what happens? You get things like the Matterhorn, that famous mountain in Switzerland. The strata in the Matterhorn are backwards to the surrounding strata. See? Now, how did that happen? Gradually. May I ask? How did that mountain get turned upside down gradually? It didn't happen that way. Catastrophe took place. God turned it over in his wrath. And why don't we take those verses to be literal? He overturns the mountains in his wrath. The whole earth trembles at the presence of the Lord. You know what happens when God draws near? Hang on, water. Okay? That's what happens when God draws near. It says the mountains quake, the earth trembles when God draws near. God draws near. And what does the Bible say about mountains when God gets really near to them? They melt like wax. Okay, but we sometimes don't believe these things because we have evolution stuck in it. We'll get to some more things like that later. Okay, so we've looked at uniformitarianism and catastrophism. We believe in catastrophe.